From Aspen Public Radio. This is Curated, stories on the artists who visit and live in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock, arts and culture reporter here at Aspen Public Radio. It is Monday, October 30th. This week, we're paying homage to the people who ignite change. On the local level, we'll hear from the Latino community working to leave their mark on future generations in Carbondale. Also, a woman shares her story of growing up in the Taliban and how it inspired her to create the only Afghani boarding school for girls. And one of the founders of the conceptual art movement, Lawrence Weiner, reflects on his legacy. Plus, music from the Stone Foxes and everything else going on this week in the Valley. Thanks for tuning in and stay with me. The Rio Grande Artway project in Carbondale has been years in the making. This fall, design on the first of three parks running linear to the trail has begun. It's also brought underserved communities into the creative process. It's a brisk Saturday morning in October. A group has gathered to lay out the groundwork for a Latino folk art garden that runs along a one-mile stretch of the Roaring Fork Valley Trail. A diverse group is preparing the walkways for what is to be a gathering space filled with gardens, hammocks, and mosaics, all of which represent them.
People from Mexico, Guatemala, and it's amazing to be all together. It doesn't matter where are from, but now are here to work like a one community for the Hispanic community.
That's Alejandra Manana. She works for the nonprofit Valley Settlement, a resource for immigrant families throughout the valley. She's brought her children to the workday because she wants them to feel like they had a hand in the creation of this place.
Latinos, we are working in that sense of to be together and doing something that made us proud here in the valley. And I think it's important to have something that feels that you were here, even if you are not here maybe in the future, but something that is, oh, I did that, or when you walk through this path, it's like, we work on that.
Her son Ricardo wields a pickaxe.
I'm digging up plants that don't have that little white thing on the branches, and if I find rocks next to them, I go and put them over there by the trail.
Kids of all ages are placing the rocks they dig up along what's becoming the Latino Folk Art Garden's path. Here's Max, a five-year-old, who aids in the heavy lifting.
I like to pick rocks and put them like in the path because it's so fun because it looks like a little trail, like a little light. And I like it because it's so fun because you get to pick every rock and you get to put them back. That's fun because you get to pick rock from there to put them back. And I like that part.
Along this new path will be art that pays homage to past and present members of the Latino community. Carlos Urrua says he was honored when he heard about the Latino Folk Art Garden's mission.
What we're really looking to do for the community is have a spot where the community can just come and relax and get together. You know, it doesn't matter what race, what language, or anything. Just come here and, you know, just be part of the community.
Amy Kimberly is the executive director of Carbondale Arts. Part of the organization's mission is to support the community through artistic projects that reflect its values.
We are making our statement here along the Rio Grande Trail, and it's a lovely statement. It gives me hope in the world.
She says it turns a daily commute down the bike path into a historical appreciation for who we are as a valley.
Immigrant stories. Someone like Moose Martinez, who in the 50s and 60s organized the coal miners here in the valley, and he was from Mexico. Or the present day stories of the journeys people have taken to be here and what they do.
Carbondale Arts is partnering with Roaring Fork Transportation Authority and Carbondale Creative District to create the Rio Grande Artway. There are two additional parks slated for completion in the next few years that will run linear to the trail Derail Park at Highway 133, where it meets the Rio Grande Trail, is in the midst of the weeding, clearing, and planting phase. Kimberly says this spot will be interactive.
It will also hold the history of a lot of old railway parts that Rafto's been, you know, holding in their yard. Now we'll get to experience them, and kids will get to learn about the railroad.
There's also the Youth Art Park at 4th Street, where it meets the Rio Grande Trail, which Kimberly says will be designed by kids in schools. Today's project readied the Latino Folk Art Garden's walkways for spring. Over the winter, the creativity will move indoors as the community is invited to participate in ceramics and other design work that will be incorporated into the garden this spring. Mananya helps pack up tools with her son.
This is so important to say, hey, this is our community too. And I want that the people, when the people walk through this, can see all the amazing colors, cultures, and everything that we have in our countries.
Claire Woodcock, Aspen Public Radio News. You're listening to Curated here on Aspen Public Radio. Coming up, a conceptual artist looks back on his career. But first, Shabana Basij Rasa is co-founder and president of SOLA, the School of Leadership in Afghanistan. This summer, she presented at the Aspen Institute's Ideas Festival and stopped by APR Studios to share with us her story.
I grew up under the Taliban regime from 1996 to 2001. And during this regime, education for girls was prohibited. It was, in fact, considered illegal to educate girls. But fortunately, I was born in a family that really valued education for girls, and that made me and my three sisters extremely lucky to be born in that family in a place like Afghanistan, where a lot of people didn't want to risk their lives or the lives of their daughters for an education. But for my parents, it was much more difficult to imagine raising their daughters without an education than to risk our lives to receive an education. So when I speak about getting educated under the Taliban regime, it's not the mental image that we have of what it means to go to school. I would sneak into somebody's house. The school that I went to was run by a woman who was high school principal before the Taliban regime. And she only allowed me and my sister to attend her school because she knew my mom. They were colleagues before the Taliban regime. So even to get into a secret school or an underground school during Taliban regime, you had to be trusted by the people because it was very risky for the families who decided to run secret schools during the Taliban regime. We could not afford to keep a routine. Because this was the secret school that we could get into, it was quite a far away from our house. Sometimes it was 40 minutes of a walk, sometimes close to an hour, depending on how we went to that house. Because we were instructed every single day to not keep a routine or make sure that we didn't create a pattern of walking through the same streets every day. So even at that really young age, I was aware that I was not only just responsible for my safety, but I was responsible for the safety of all the other girls and this family and my family, especially the girls who attended that secret school with me. And so, you know, of course, it was quite a lot of responsibility. But I think the part today, when I think back about the secret school and sneaking into somebody's house to receive an education, that really shocks me and surprises me is that I grew up thinking it was normal. That was how girls received an education. I only realized that what I was doing was unbelievably abnormal. It was after the Taliban regime, when I stepped into a public school for the very first time in my life. This was in 2002, so after 9/11. This was in Kabul City. And for me, of course, there was a dramatic change in routine. Everything I did to go to that public school was completely the opposite of what I did during the Taliban regime. So in 2002, I went to public school in the exact same time and came home at the exact same time. Whereas under the Taliban regime, I sometimes left early in the morning, sometimes midday, or sometimes late in the afternoon. And never, ever did we know when we would return home during the day, because we didn't know when we would be allowed to leave the home, because the family had to decide who they let out, and they made sure that there was at least 10-minute break in between one or two or a group of students leaving their house, and they would always ask us to walk away as fast as we could from that neighborhood. After the Taliban regime, I wore a uniform that indicated loud and clear I was a schoolgirl, whereas under the Taliban regime, I disguised as a boy to accompany my sister to that secret school, just so that we could receive an education. In 2002, I had teachers who taught me different subjects who didn't wear a burqa when they were outside their home. Whereas under the Taliban regime, it was one-on-one lessons in somebody's living room. And I had never seen any woman walking outside without wearing the burqa. So there was quite a bit of change for an 11-year-old girl to go through in 2012. In my view, right now, the beginning of why I do what I do today. I have co-founded, and I'm the president of the first and, as far as I know, the only boarding school for girls in Afghanistan. And quickly, as I was looking at all the problems in Afghanistan on a national level, whether that was ethnic discrimination, particularly for young girls in rural Afghanistan, a lack of access to any basic education, I realized that the best way forward was to create a safe and nurturing academic environment in the form of a boarding school so that we could bring students from all over Afghanistan to this space who could share this experience together and learn to become the future leaders of Afghanistan together. And we do this by bringing students in sixth grade when they're really young, with the hopes of working with them through 12th grade and then placing them all into colleges and universities in Afghanistan and in the region and anywhere in the world. The reason we focus on bringing students into 6th grade is because at this age, girls in Afghanistan are still seen as girls and not women. So it's much easier to convince the families to allow their daughters to come to an environment like a boarding school. I mean, we are localizing this model for the first time in Afghanistan. It has never been done before. So we have to be very careful in how we introduce it, but also to make sure that people understand the value of such an education, especially for young girls. Unlike a lot of people in Afghanistan, they haven't developed the hate for other groups in Afghanistan. And when we give them an opportunity to live and learn with people from across Afghanistan, they develop friendships organically with these other young girls from across the country who I hope will be their colleagues in the future as they lead the country. It gives us time to work with students, especially from rural Afghanistan, to address their academic gaps and needs before they reach high school. In a lot of times, I go around the U.S. talking about the school that I've started in Afghanistan on girls' education, and most often people assume that the number one reason why girls in Afghanistan cannot receive an education is because of traditional beliefs that people, especially Afghan men, don't want girls to receive an education. But in fact, the number one reason why girls in Afghanistan do not often go beyond elementary school is because of lack of teachers, and most specifically, lack of female teachers. So our short-term goal is to expand the school to 350 students in the next few years. So we're hoping to add about 25 students per grade each year so that we can have students in 6th through 12th grade in the next 7 years. It's an education that they receive to make a difference in the lives of people in Afghanistan, especially the millions of other girls in Afghanistan and elsewhere in the world who don't have access to receive an education today.
That was Shabana Basij Rasa. For more information on SOLA, visit sola-afghanistan.org. Do you have a story like Shabana's you want to tell? It can be about anything, like the time you triumphed over your first 14er, or you received a love letter that changed your world. Send your pitches to Claire at aspenpublicradio.org. Make sure to detail the stakes, identify some sort of turning point, and tell me what you learned from that experience. Aspen Public Radio is your story, your station. Artist Lawrence Weiner is known as a central figure of the conceptual art movement of the 1960s. He was big on using typography in his work. This year, he received the Aspen Art Museum's annual award for art. Here he is in an interview at the Art Museum before being honored at this year's Art Crush Gala.
I'll be a happy camper. There comes things that nobody thought would ever happen, and you do them. And people just say, that's not right, or it is right. But in fact, if you watch that, it worked out okay.
How do you think that art can benefit society today?
By presenting a logic system that transposes from the person's private life. And if it doesn't have a morals and kind of holding things together, as a, it's very useful for people to be able to understand their place in the sun, where they are. You have to do that, and nobody ever is embarrassed to say, I'm trying to find out where I fit in. But art allows you to, because you can relate it to objects. And in relating it to objects and sulfur and this and that, it functions. That's what I think it's about. Not anything else. The fact that something meant something to you, that's like the poem that you remember when you were a child, the song that you won't forget, and the drawing that you had in your bedroom. That's what art is supposed to be. It becomes a souvenir of something that allowed you to figure out who you were in the world that you found yourself in. Really, it really is just logical.
You said something about how art is actually a middle class structure, and I thought that was really fascinating.
That used to be when they used to allow everybody into the art world, and the academy took it over, the universities, and they don't allow anybody in except the middle class. That's all. The ruling class, if they have enough means, is not going to waste their time 8 years sitting around drinking beer and smoking joints with people about nothing. You don't learn anything. It's the strangest thing. You watch people say, oh, well, I have a this, that, and the other thing in fine art. Okay, well, what did your teacher discover? Nothing. What have you discovered? Nothing. But I have a career. It's not a life. Art is something that you choose. It's like research medicine. It becomes obvious if you've done anything, and whether they accept it or not is not, in effect, your problem. Your problem of survival, if you don't come from the right class, that's a big problem, but other countries and other cultures have beat that by making it no longer such a special privilege to be an artist. And it's possible then, because then everybody's entitled to enough to eat and medical care and a roof on their head and a public library.
When did you see that turn happen? I mean, like now we have people that graduate with their bachelor's or their master's in fine arts, and they graduate $60,000 in debt.
Most of the time they didn't fulfill their master's degree because they had to write a research paper in another language, and they're monolingual, which means they don't have a master's degree. Yeah, it's like having a driver's license and not having driven. It's odd. I don't know where they discovered why. You know, it's the last profession besides fashion that you don't need a license in order to do it. Everything else requires a certificate. And why they want to make this certified, I don't know. You should be better off making art and then worrying about the accreditation later. As a child, I chose not to take my bachelor's and wander off into the world because it was explained to me by a very, very nice teacher. Who was an artist who needed the money, that if you do it, that what happens is, why can't you make your name by doing what it is you do? And if you need a certificate later, if you have a bachelor's, you'll have to get a master's if you have to teach, if you want a kid or something. And you have to do that. If you don't have a bachelor's, they just have to make you an honorary professor and you teach. It worked out that way, but it doesn't work that way anymore. It doesn't. The world has changed. It used to be a lot easier to break the class lines and all in the United States. Physically hard. You lived without heat. You take your kid to an emergency ward instead of a clinic or a doctor. But in fact, it was worth the triple.
Can you tell me about the role text and language plays in your work?
Very easily. Every object that you see in the world, the only way you know you're seeing is that if you gave it a name. It's like, you know, when children are making all those noises, they're saying something. They literally are, except you don't speak the language, you don't take the trouble because you're the big person. They have to learn your language in order to make it clear to you what they want. I found myself making work that seemed to resonate in the society, it seemed to be useful, but I reached the point where I couldn't say what I wanted with the means that I had. And language entered into it, because if you see a stone, it's a stone. Stone. I'm not very much interested in contractions, so it's stone, brimstone, which is sulfur, and water. And if that doesn't make a typical sculpture, you're in trouble, because that's all it is. It's not a fantasy, and it's certainly not a dream. It's objects put together that you can make sense out of to understand the world. It doesn't mean that everybody else can, but you do. And you stick to it, and you'll find the six people left in the world that understand what you're talking about, and then you're lucky.
Has it always been easy for you to make art, or did you ever have times where you doubted yourself?
When I returned from San Francisco in the 60s, I went out just to make this piece, and because of the City Lights bookshop and things, I lost all faith in the art world. I saw it changing over into this academy, and I'm, by chance, in New York at the time, I got a really good public education. And I'm one of those people, if I say I'll do it, I'll read it. Whether I understand it or not is another question. And I became so upset that all I did for years, two, I think, would make things for children. Copies of David Smith, things like that, and out of knobs and paint. Yes, I lose faith. I lost faith in sometime in the 70s because of the American involvement in Vietnam. But essentially, making art, it was a vocation. And I went along with it. But it's not easy. I wish it were. It looks easy. But the trick with art is, it's like being a chef. There's nobody's business that it's backbreaking work to do. It's what it is and whether you can get it. So it's just the people who are so used to whining, they want to tell you how hard it was to do it. But you did it. You succeeded. Well, I didn't get as much money as so-and-so. It's not an answer. It's not about that. It's about choosing to try to do something and doing it as best you can. So making art is not an easy job. Living the life of making art when you're reasonably successful or not at all successful is still about the same drudgery.
So how did you get your groove back?
Oh, I don't know. I honestly don't. One day you wake up, and I think everybody has this, whatever their profession is, and you realize that you are you because of that. And you then look at it and think, oh, I'm shirking, I should enter back in and take care of it. You do, and then you do it for a while, and then you get disappointed or you get disillusioned. But in the end, I think it's the same for absolutely everybody. There's somebody being running a small shop. You know, it has its ups and downs.
What do you want people to take away from your art? What do you want them to experience?
Change in logic structure. A change in what the hierarchy of their logic is. That, in fact, it would be nice if they were doing something because they really thought it should be done. That's what I'd like. And that's what you get when you have real art. That's what I got from beginning to understand Mondrian as a child. It had nothing to do with the system. Nothing to do with the system whatsoever. It had to do with a reality that you were willing to stand in.
That was conceptual artist Lawrence Weiner. You're listening to Curated on Aspen Public Radio. Here's a track from the San Francisco-based band The Stone Foxes. It's called If I Die.
If I die tonight, that's all right. 'Cause I leave my heart on my sleeve. And I leave all my sweat on the floor. And if I lived any harder and I don't know how, you couldn't take much more. Yes, if I die tonight, woo, alright, cause I always pass the gin, and I never took my medicine. And if you ask me now, kid, how'd you do? I say I'd do it all again. You're with me now, you're with me now. We're dancing in the crimson light. That's why if I die tonight, yeah, that's all right. Shot, I shot to kill, and I've been cut through right to the heart like nobody ever will. Yes, if I die tonight, oh, that's all right, cause I never step out alone, and I always try to take it home, and I'm good and ready, but I never leave, never leave. That's why if I die tonight, woo, that's all right.
That was a new track from the Stone Foxes called If I Die. These San Francisco-based blues rockers will play the Belly Up Thursday night at 10 o'clock p.m. For more information, visit bellyupaspen.com. Here's what else is happening this week in the Valley.
Tuesday, in celebration of Halloween, the Red Brick Center for the Arts and Aspen Recreation Center present Boobash, food, games, and art at the Aspen Fire Station, starting at 3 o'clock p.m. Then on Tuesday night, there will be a Halloween dance party with partner dancing in the Round Room at the 3rd Street Center in Carbondale. It all starts at 7 o'clock p.m. Thursday at the Temporary, there will be a screening of Colorado filmmaker David Quint's documentary, Father Unknown, starting at 6:30 p.m. in Basalt. As part of First Friday in Carbondale, Thunder River Theater Company and Carbondale Arts presents the 13th annual Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead festivities, starting at 5 o'clock p.m. over at the 3rd Street Center. Friday at the Glenwood Vaudeville Review, stand-up comedian Josh Blue from NBC's Last Comic Standing will perform. That show starts at 7 o'clock p.m. And Saturday, Seth Gleer will perform at the Wheeler as part of the Opera House's On the Rise series. That show starts at 7:30 p.m.
That's all that's curated this week. For more on arts and culture, visit aspenpublicradio.org, where all episodes of this show live. I produced today's show all by myself. It was edited by Allison Bektesh. Local musicians Greg Lau and Jason Patton wrote the show's theme tune, Omnicorn Entrance. Special thanks to the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation, which aims to support the arts, community, and outreach. Continue to follow Curated APR on Facebook for news and updates on arts in the Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. Thank you so much for listening. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.